Welcome to Intelligent Systems, the podcast of the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. I'm your host, Dr. Leah Windsor. I'm the director of the Institute for Intelligent Systems and an associate professor of applied linguistics at the University of Memphis. I study language and society. My work explores the question, how does what we say reveal who we are? In this podcast, we will explore the dynamics of intelligent systems, including interactions between and among humans, computers, and groups of sentient and non-sentient beings. The Institute for Intelligent Systems has three key areas: language, learning, and artificial intelligence. We will explore and define what an intelligent system is and talk about intelligent systems in practice across these three issue areas. Today's guest is Dr. Josh Rosenberg. Dr. Rosenberg is an associate professor of STEM education and a faculty fellow for the Center for Enhancing Education in Mathematics and Sciences at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He studies the use of data in education, especially in STEM education contexts, and is joining us today to give the public lecture for our cognitive science seminar on the psychology of digital media literacy. Welcome to the Intelligent Systems Podcast, Josh.
Thank you so much, Dr. Windsor. It's an honor to be here.
Leah, please.
Thank you.
Okay, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your academic story?
Sure thing. My name is Josh Rosenberg. Thank you for the very generous introduction. And
it reads very close to your university bio.
Well, no, it's got a little... I don't know. Hearing you say it, there's something about it. It's very nice. Yeah. I am a former public high school science teacher.
Okay.
That is the beginning of all of my scholarship, is having taught mostly 10th grade students and taught mostly biology. And so everything I do is grounded in an appreciation for the challenges of teaching, the work of teachers, the reality of being a student in a classroom, the challenges of being a student in a modern classroom.
Yeah.
And so that's first. Second, I went to grad school with an interest in technology, and I quickly was entranced by, I wasn't a programmer. I've never taken, that's not true. After I learned to program, I took one class, but I never had a programming class, but I started grad school in 2012.
Okay.
When there was just starting to be public attention around the ideas that we now call like data science and big data. And,
right.
Yeah. And so I got interested in those ideas and learned a lot, took a lot of stats classes, not a lot of programming classes, and then was sort of learning programming just like nonstop. I would go to bed with an R book next to my nightstand and fall asleep reading it and wake up reading it. And so I got obsessed, and I kind of let myself get obsessed with that. And so did a lot with data science, explored a lot of new methods, wrote a book called Data Science and Education Using R. And then sort of at some point in the last few years kind of shifted my focus a bit to asking the question, hey, we can do all this cool stuff as researchers with data and programming languages like R and Python. Can teachers and students do stuff too, especially at the K-12 level? So my two big buckets of my work are innovating with methods, again, kind of bringing my sensitivity to the work of teachers and the lives of learners to that work. And then second, shifting my focus and asking how can we as designers of tools or teaching strategies or curricula help teachers and students to do more ambitious things with data and computing.
Yeah. You know, I feel like in many ways I am an unlikely person. At this point in my career, I consider myself a computational social scientist. And that I find to be really surprising because I was never strong in math. I didn't grow up taking computers apart and loving, you know, the technology side of things. And it really wasn't until graduate school. I mean, I did so abysmally on my GRE math. And it wasn't until graduate school that it clicked for me. And now I feel like if I can do it, anybody can do it. And I think what it was just putting it in the context of something meaningful and not abstract or not, you know, removed from practice. I don't know.
Thank you for sharing that. I took calculus, I can't remember if it was twice or three times, because I didn't pass it the first or second time.
Yeah. Our calculus teacher was named Mr. Catalpa, and we called it Catalpulus. And I don't know. I mean, he was a fine person and a fine teacher, but you know, I think all of us just kind of skated through under the radar a bit. I honestly don't know how I passed the class. I mean, I don't know.
But you passed it.
I passed it somehow. I don't know. But I think it was maybe just pity because, you know, all the rest of us were in other honors classes. And I don't know. I certainly don't remember anything from it.
So I think there's something really important to what you said about having a goal that motivates why you want to use data and computing or math.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is thinking through this, to be honest, I think that's a big opportunity for K-12 learning is to bring more of those opportunities into what we call a classroom context and help learners to have that chance to develop that goal and to build that motivation to use data and computing to amplify what they could do or to do things differently.
And, you know, I've been thinking a lot in the conversations with other guest speakers this semester about the role of novices and experts. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with math or science, that at least I have the perception that everybody else always knows more than I do, or that everybody else is an expert. But this semester, I have watched some of my freshmen tackle problems with hard problems with greater ease than my graduate students that I give the same problems. And it's not that they're smarter than the graduate students. The graduate students have very specialized knowledge, and I feel like that kind of gets in their way. And so I wonder, like, how can we harness this, like, beginner's luck, novice to, I don't know, to give students more confidence or...
Wow, yeah, that's a... Agree. Sorry,
it's early.
No, it's not too early.
I should have offered coffee.
Nope. I'm good. I've got my water. I mean that implicates a lot of questions around technology and learning and kind of interdisciplinarity.
Yeah.
And breadth of knowledge.
How do you get students excited and engaged, or like what's the entry point?
When I teach a data science class now, I think speccing out a question which a student would want to find out the answer to is surprisingly hard. I mean, there's a lot of a lot of bad examples out there, and then one that's sufficiently open-ended and that you can reach different answers and defend those. That's one way. I think that for most students, something like that is really hard work, really intellectual work to develop those kinds of assignments in there. I mean, I think it's probably the case too where something is better than, well, maybe not. So part of my goal in teaching a data science class is to not do what many have done or many classes do, which is to start with the very small kind of isolated skill, something like in Python, how to manipulate a dict. And then maybe at the very end you get to work with a data set, more foregrounding the big goal and the reason why we might use data to begin with. Maybe why do we even use data?
I love this.
And then back into the more either programming, computer science, or the more mathematical ideas as needed. You don't need to start with those necessarily without seeing the end reason.
Yeah. When I started learning methodology and statistics, I had this idea that I had to know everything, you know, and that people who are methodologists know all of the methods and the estimators and all of the things. And it's not true. Like, the right method is the one that's right for the data, you know? And starting with the big why it's really hard, but also really important. That is so smart to do that.
hard to do. Like we're trying at the University of Tennessee to develop data science classes that have broad appeal. And
yeah,
it's really easy to go wrong. It's right. And I think there's like a way to do it wrong that looks right, which is to have a lot of kind of technical stuff packed in there.
Yeah.
No one's going to really tell you you're a bad instructor if you spend a week on dicts and a week on lists and a week on list comprehensions.
Yeah.
And a week on data frame. But it's not going to serve students well. And so maybe the bias needs to be toward the bigger problems and asking questions about why we use data in computing at all. Like, what do they empower or enable humans to do?
And maybe developing an intuition about, or a feel for things that, you're smiling, say more.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, there's, you can have the technical chops, but lack the intuition to know if you're in the right ballpark. You know, my husband is a mathematician here, and he didn't grow up in the U.S., he grew up in New Zealand, and there's just very different philosophy about numeracy and, you know, numerical competency there. And one of the things that he's talked about a lot is just how important it is to develop a feel for things, and I think that that's important in the context of something, like giving yourself the bounds of a good research question to be able to say, like, is this about right?
Yes.
Versus, like, did I get all the technical things right?
Yeah. Is this about right?
Yeah.
That's interesting phrasing. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That connects to a definition of data science, which I think can be overdone, but there's this kind of infamous definition that came out of a blog post, believe it or not, in 2010, I believe, by someone working in industry, Drew Conway. And it defines data science as like hacking skills, which you can read as like some computing skills,
right?
Kind of stats skills. And then the third is subject area expertise or knowledge. And that's another case of if you lack it, you can look like you're doing the right work, but it might actually fall flat. So in my field, I see all the time people who are like, I'm doing topic modeling with this big data set. And it's like, but wait, what's the question and why does the answer matter? And really lacking that sensitivity to the domain or intuition about what are important problems.
Yes.
And so something that novices can bring is, you know, I know that there's this problem. I'm not exactly sure how all the details will come together, but that's probably a better starting point than, again, I know how to manipulate a dict in Python.
Yeah, right. And I think that sometimes novices or people looking at things with fresh eyes, there's a great book called Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, that is just a good reminder that the more you know about something, it can almost, make the obvious invisible in a way that to a novice, like I think that novices ask really good questions that cut at the heart of what an issue is. And what I've observed is that, at least in my graduate classes, they're trying to carve out a niche of something that is like, there's not a why to it. It's a more of a, how does X influence Y? Or what does Y do to Z? Rather than like, why are X and Y important? And I think that seeing that with fresh eyes, I mean, I spend at least 3 weeks with my students just crafting their why question, because everything else is built from that. You know, and it's hard to ask a good why question.
Interesting. Yeah. Two quick reactions to that. One is, I've now taught a machine learning like summer workshop for 3 or 4.
Okay.
And it's taken me 4 years to learn what the lesson behind what you just shared, which is getting that why is so critical. So for years I've had PhD level researchers say, I want to do machine learning. I ask why, the answer is, well, I've got a lot of data. So then the question I asked back is like, well, could you like run like a regression model? Well, maybe, but the data is so big. But wait, is that really an issue for regression? It's like, right. You got 10,000 rows versus 1,000. The regression's going to do fine.
Yeah.
You can just focus on effect sizes if you're concerned about,
yes,
about practically insignificant but statistically significant. But anyway, it takes so much time and effort, even with very talented researchers, to overcome the conception that because this method or this technique is new, that it's necessarily better, rather than spending more time refining your why. Why machine learning? Why do I care about making predictions, for instance? That's a much harder question, actually, than how do I specify some random forest model or some boosted
tree model. I mean, I learned LaTeX and Beamer, I don't know what you'd call it, like hard coding document language or whatever. And I learned that because that was like a signaling thing, that you had this skill. Like if you showed up with a PowerPoint, that said something about your technical chops.
Oh, interesting.
Versus like showing up with a Beamer presentation, which was like, oh, she's got skills with a Z, you know? But one of the things that you just said about like significance and importance, this has come up so many times already this semester, and it's not something that I had thought about before or really had to articulate, but you know, I drew out the XY axis on the board, and I was like, you know, you can have statistically significant or insignificant, and you can have important or like degrees of importance, like really important or not so important.
Yeah.
And something can be very statistically significant and not all that interesting, or you can have something that is not statistically significant and quite interesting, right? And
yeah, well said. That's very Bayesian kind of expression, that it's not this kind of yes, no, kind of this is significant or not, but
related to effect sizes.
Belief. Yeah.
Too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me what you're going to be talking about today. Can you give a little preview on your...
Oh, sure. Oh, sorry, Leah, I did have one other
small, please.
Just, I just want to register this. I do think there's maybe an interesting wrinkle to explore around, like, having some knowledge about different domains is probably... I'll make the strong case for the, you know, for the audience here. Like, maybe more important than before, because it is pretty easy in an era of AI to learn about different domains or different techniques, or even write code for you to do different analyses.
Yeah.
But this is maybe a nice connection to the Bayesian work. If you have no initial conception of what these techniques are, what your problem is, as we've been talking about,
Yeah. You
can easily be kind of over-influenced by a certain technique and its power. And so I think
Yes. There's
still an important role for having maybe not expert-level expertise in Yes. Every different possible topic or analytic technique, but having a working understanding of how and why there are these different parts of the problem we're investigating, so that we can sort of make informed choices about
what to do. Yeah, it's like when you first learn OLS and you just want to regress everything, right? And, like, sometimes it's not appropriate,
Yeah. You
know? And you
Yeah. Just...
But I think that that's also... Like, there's this, you know... beginner's enthusiasm for things. I mean, children do it developing language, right? They over apply rules for, you know, past tense, Right? Like, I holded the baby bunny, right? And then eventually they kind of, you know, prune away the overgeneralization and wind up at, you know, understanding the nuance and the rules of the syntax. But I think it's like harnessing that enthusiasm and saying, and you also have to be a conscientious consumer of all of this new knowledge.
I think that's the formulation.
Yeah. So tell us about your talk.
Sure. So I, as maybe like this, as my path to my academic, through my academic career suggests, I have kind of a bit of potpourri-like interests, and they're kind of in both like using methods and data and computing, and then also supporting teachers and students to use data and computing. And so I'm actually principally going to talk about more research-related uses, but then at the end I'm going to talk a little bit about some strategies that teachers and students can use.
Okay.
So I'll briefly talk about, really briefly just right now, talk about each of them.
Yeah.
So one of them comes from a series of studies that started really small with trying to use social media data to answer questions about things that I was already interested in as a former teacher and as someone interested in educational technology. So my colleagues and I literally were looking at a hashtag associated with the master's degree program that some of us taught, like TA classes in.
Huh.
And we found out, hey, students are actually using Twitter with a hashtag for the class to like share like tips about like how to navigate the learning management system, or just sharing resources or sharing work that they did.
Yeah.
We thought, oh, that's really cool. Basically, could we like survey students about how they're using Twitter? And then what happened, the kind of aha moment that unlocked a lot of things, was a colleague who I was teaching with at the time said, hey, I found this thing called a Twitter archiving Google sheet. This is really like antiquated technologically, but it was like, this is 2013 or 14, maybe 2012.
Very cutting edge.
More than a decade ago. It was literally a Google sheet where you like input a, you had to like sign into Twitter and get a an API code, a key, basically. And you would then basically click some buttons in the Google Sheet to like authenticate. And then you could specify search terms. And the Twitter archiving Google Sheet, so funny. Like every hour, it would basically query Twitter's data through the application programming interface to collect every tweet that met those search terms. It had a limit. It could collect like 100 an hour or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But it was awesome in that we set these up for every hashtag in the master's program. And before we knew it, we had hundreds and then thousands and then on the order of tens of thousands of tweets over a kind of multi-year span.
Oh my goodness.
Including kind of program-wide hashtags and then course-specific hashtags. And so we wrote a paper that was basically just describing this data. We did some qualitative coding. What are the different purposes that people tweeted? And that was sort of the entry to kind of get to the point here. A couple studies I did around science education that sort of leveraged those same two big pieces of, hey, something cool is happening here, and hey, we've now got some methods that let us analyze this data in new ways. Not just asking people, but looking at something like digital records of their interactions. And so one study that I'll be talking about is looking at every post on the social media platform Twitter about the next generation science standards, building on an intuition that, hey, something's good about these science standards. They're being adopted by many states. There's not a lot of pushback. They've kind of avoided political critique or partisanship. So that's a study that sort of tries to quantify that intuition using millions of tweets. And then the second study looks at a particular community of teachers and researchers and administrators and not-for-profit organization representatives who used a hashtag called hashtag NGSSChat to broadly discuss, debate, share, coordinate around the NGSS.
And the NGSS.
I'm sorry. This is a case of cursive knowledge. Thinking that's the Next Generation Science Standards.
Got you. Okay.
Which are, I'll talk more about these in the talk, but basically a standards-based reform effort that has been surprisingly successful in through the present day. In fact, 49 U.S. states have adopted standards based on the NGSS.
Wow.
And so kind of one of the punchlines of the talk is that the people leading the NGSS and the people leading this Twitter-based community took made strategic decisions about how to structure the reform and the community in ways that built public trust in science education and maybe ultimately in science. So that's kind of that's one use of kind of using data, building on these intuitions. Anyway, that's one thing. The second thing is kind of different, but it's like, and these analyses, and sorry, to get a little technical, very briefly, both of those studies use multi-level models, which have a connection to Bayesian approaches.
Right.
They have a connection. The connection in my mind is that in a multi-level model, you use all of the data.
Yeah.
As something like a kind of weight to consider the effect of data for a specific group.
Yep.
So it's got this Bayesian feel of like, is this group really that different from all the groups or all the data overall?
Right.
If so, the evidence has got to be pretty good. Like there's got to be quite a big difference and there's got to be a decent amount of data in order to kind of move away from that prior.
Yeah.
And that just way of thinking was really transformational to me. Just this idea of sort of weighting based on not only the size of the sample, but also the weight of the evidence.
Yeah.
And started doing some Bayesian analyses myself. And then I forget when, but had this idea, hey, this could actually overcome a lot of the challenges that science teachers and students face when analyzing data and trying to understand, usually without a math class to go along with it,
right.
What's a p-value? What is a t-test? What's a z-statistic?
Right.
What's a t-statistic?
Right.
They don't have opportunities in many K-12 classes to learn about those, but many either standards either implicitly or explicitly suggest to teachers they need to teach those, which is really hard if you're a science teacher, really confusing if you're a science learner. And then on the other hand, this language of the Bayesian approach is quite intuitive. It's basically, what do you think now? What do you think after looking at some evidence or interpreting some information in the data? And what do you think after that, kind of considering both what you initially thought and what the data tells you?
Yeah.
In the language of confidence. So I'm very confident. I'm not sure. I'm 80 to 90% confident. This kind of language can be much more accessible than a p-value is less than 0.05. And that tells us that we failed to reject the null hypothesis, but we don't actually have support for the alternative hypothesis. It's very convoluted. So that's the other thing I'm talking about. And that could be another way we can build trust in science is by talking about data and evidence in terms of degrees of confidence rather than in terms of yes-no answers, kind of p-values.
So when I took the Bayesian class many years ago, was it 2014, I think, learning about rope or the region of practical equivalence blew my mind, right? And, you know, talking, I had never thought about numbers a whole lot. And I remember talking with my husband and him saying, like, there's an infinite number of numbers between whole numbers. I was like, oh my God, you're right. Like, that's wild, you know? Like, it was, that realization was on the order of magnitude of, like, learning that vanilla is its own flavor. It's not just absence of chocolate, you know? And how arbitrary a p-value is, that it's not, it's just not this one thing, right? Like, it's not even a schmear. It's like, your result is not equal to zero, or we're going to tolerate, like, this range of whatever. But I think the bigger part of what you were saying around uncertainty and especially public confidence and trust, and this, again, probably because of the theme of the cognitive science semester or seminar, is that public confidence in science, it had not occurred to me to think about it in Bayesian terms. But when scientists say uncertainty, we mean bounded uncertainty. It's not that we're guessing. And I think that the general public may perceive that if a scientist or a study says, you know, we can say this with, you know, whatever percent confidence, or we're not sure about something, that what they're doing is just good science and not overclaiming, right? And going too far beyond what the study actually says. But what the public actually hears is they have no idea, right? Versus they have an idea, but maybe not the complete idea, right? And so if we were to help the public understand that, like, here's the body of consensus science versus frontier science, like, here's what we all generally agree on, I've envisioned it as like sailboat tacking. Like, you go back and forth a little bit, but you don't make enormous adjustments often, maybe, but just understanding that, like, there's no fixed capital T truth, that, like, everything is an update of your priors.
Oh, wonderfully said. Yeah, it's a simple shift, but it could have some profound implications.
Yeah.
It cuts in a lot of different ways. Like, also, scientists sometimes, I'm someone, maybe we share this, I like to kind of criticize my own kind of group. Maybe because the flaws are more evident, maybe because I feel like I have more influence. There's a difference, to build on your point, between frontier science and consensus science. But to talk about a study, let's say, that's in each of those two buckets the same way, could be a mistake, because when the frontier science ends up a year from now looking quite different, the public could understandably say, wait, you told us a year ago that this was the case, this was true. You said that it was significant, that this is what the study found. But that's very different from something that we have a high degree of confidence about from hundreds or thousands or even more studies that have kind of withstood a lot of different robustness checks and sensitivity analyses and other contingencies. And so it gives maybe a more of a language to talk about, you know, this is something we're, you know, 96 to 99.99% sure about. This is something we're 60% sure about. Those are very different things.
Yes. And also teaching scientists to better communicate their work, right? Like, there's a skill set that I learned several years ago from the Compass Science Communication Group. It's called the Message Box, and it is just amazing. I use this every single semester to help the students craft their research abstract after their, you know, labor-intensive zeroing in on the why question. But, you know, watching the movie Don't Look Up, have you seen that? With Leonardo DiCaprio? Watch Don't Look Up. Like, what I really wanted to do was just press pause and be like, somebody let me teach Leonardo DiCaprio the message box, because they might have avoided the thing. I'm not going to spoil it for you. But, you know, if he had been more effective in communicating the thing, right? And I think it's important that we are able to talk with anybody about what we do, you know? It's, I was just teaching my students on Monday about the fuzzy trace theory, about gist versus verbatim. Like, people don't want the verbatim, and they don't necessarily need it. Like, give them the gist, and then if they want more information, give them a little bit of verbatim, you know? Yeah.
Maybe connecting to that last point, Leah, like, maybe another benefit of talking about science, not in terms of right and wrong answers or yes, no, but in terms of competence, is it invites a discussion.
Yes.
And I think that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. Importantly, a discussion doesn't mean, if we're climate scientists, we will happily be open to the idea that the weight of evidence about our changing Earth climate system is indeed well underway. But it means that we treat people with respect.
Yes.
And we let them have a chance to share their concerns and their questions. And we are steadfast in what we know and believe, but we are willing to have a discussion and not just say, you're wrong.
Yeah. This, gosh, it's so funny how everything converges on a theme sometimes. One of the things I wanted to ask about is about, like, what does it mean to think like a Bayesian? How do you teach thinking like a Bayesian? And then the thing that was that just clicked for me is how Bayesian thinking can help groups collaborate better. And I think that respect also, my dad is a clinical psychologist, and I have grown up reading all of the things on his bookshelf. And so I am an amateur student of Bowen family dynamics and Bowen family systems theory.
You get a lot of good readings from this. This is great. Message box and Bowen.
Yes, Bowen family systems theory. Yeah. And one of the things that Bowen said was that systems that are reactive are not necessarily conducive to good conversation or good, like, if one person is very, very anxious or if everybody is very anxious, they're all going to be very reactive to each other, which doesn't allow for good discussion or productive discussion. And so I think maybe thinking like a Bayesian can help dial down the anxiety and the reactivity and just help people talk, you know? And a therapist friend of mine once said, like, get curious, not furious, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what does it mean to you to think like a Bayesian? How do we teach people to think like a Bayesian?
So, yeah, Bayes' theorem is a mathematical expression, but it's been used as a model for explaining kind of either positively, that is, descriptively, or normatively, in terms of how we should, based on math,
right?
update ideas in light of initial ideas.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of implications of this. One of them is that if you have an initial belief of, I think this thing is 0% possible or probable, or an initial belief of, I think this is 100% possible or probable,
right,
mathematically, the evidence doesn't matter. Your conclusion will be the same as your initial starting point if you start at 0% or 100% strictly.
Got it. Yes.
And this connects back to your discussion with your partner who's a mathematician about how there's an infinite number of numbers
yes.
between any range of numbers. That applies here for sure in that the only kind of way data couldn't change you, or experience, you could call it even, the world couldn't change your views, is if you strictly have a 0% or 100% belief. So in some ways, that's kind of an anti-dogmatic feature of this yeah. mathematical formula, which is, again, that if a student comes in or if a scientist comes in and says, I think this idea has 0% plausibility, then no amount of data could actually move them from that initial belief. Now, okay, having said that, if you have a belief, an initial belief of, I think this is not even 1% likely, I don't even think it's a tenth of 1% likely, but sure, I'll consider the fact, then under some extreme circumstance, data could move you from that belief. And so I guess I'm not sure if this is quite getting at your question of how do you teach Bayesian reasoning, but one idea is to let kids just play around with the idea. And we have been building some digital tools that let you specify, here's my initial confidence, here's how strong I think the evidence is, here's my conclusion. And learners will really quickly see, if I say I'm 100% sure that the cause of these plants growing taller than these plants is because they've received more nitrogen, it doesn't matter if the data tells you it's actually more phosphorus, that was what was lacking,
right.
that's what's growing.
Right.
You're not going to change. Just literally, mathematically, there's nothing that can change your view. But if you say, I'm actually 98% sure that it's because these plants receive more nitrogen, then the data could maybe change you to, after looking at the data, I'm actually only 80% sure now.
Yeah.
And maybe if I collect more data, that would go down further and I'd actually build confidence in an alternative idea. So I guess my answer is like letting kids play around with the idea without having to do the calculations, which could involve either some algebra or in some cases some calculus, which is
yeah.
for many of us quite difficult. But playing around with supports that let us see the implications of Bayesian thinking can be a really nice tool. And then another thing, last thing I'll mention is just related to what you said earlier about group dynamics.
Yeah.
Just letting kids kind of put out there in the world, here's my confidence, could itself be a nexus for discussion and maybe, discussion and maybe productive kind of sharing of views. So we found in some work with teachers introducing these ideas to them, with the plan being that they will consider using them with their students, that just asking the question of a group of science teachers, how confident are you in this this scientific claim or this idea,
right,
can surface a lot of different starting points,
where
some teacher will say, I'm 90% sure because I read about this in a book, and I'm only 50% sure because I really don't know anything about this, and I'm 95% sure because I actually studied this in grad school.
Uh-huh.
And surfacing those and then looking at data and seeing how people update their beliefs in different ways can be sort of a point of reflection and discussion that can be really fruitful for
fascinating,
maybe conceptual change eventually.
So how do you think we move people off of the 0 or the 100?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the first challenge. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? That's a great question.
I don't know. I mean, so, you know, when faced with facts or emotions, you know, if something challenges a fundamental belief, if there's a fact that contradicts what you already believe, you're going to discount that fact and double down on what you already believe because of your emotional connection to that.
Identity, connection, yeah, emotions, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, part of me feels like there's a storytelling element to this or a humanizing element that, you know, if we think that something is 0% likely or 100% likely, like to me that indicates a lot of rigidity,
mm-hmm.
and things that are rigid are more reactive.
Yes.
And so how do you introduce in a gentle and I don't know, non-threatening, validating way that you don't have to be 0 or 100%, and it's not going to be a house of cards where everything that you believe collapses, you're just introducing a new way of thinking about something. And
I love the way you specified that. Yeah, I think that's in some ways the core question, or a core question, if we're interested in inviting kids who might not see themselves as scientists to think scientifically.
Yeah.
Inviting people who might see science as very removed from their lives or sources of information they trust.
Right.
So yeah, that first step strikes. I think you spec'd it out. Don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know either. But I think that there's this. I was thinking as you were talking about the Jimmy Fallon book, Everything Is Mama, and how like. The children's book. I guess I'm on a children's book kick today with the
Fabian for books. Babies. No, it's good. We got a whole range of different books we've covered.
Welcome to my mind. But how, you know, there is this like blanket generalization, but as we get older, we have a greater tolerance for nuance. And I don't know. I think there's a lot to, I mean, we can look at individuals, but we're all in a greater context that is, you know, exhibiting a lot of rigidity and anxiety. So I don't know. I really do think that humanizing, though, is a...
Humanizing is a good word.
Yeah.
I think there's a concern on the part of some science educators, some scientists, that if we welcome or even tolerate dissenting ideas, that can open this Pandora's box.
Yes.
Where things are then kind of nihilistic scientifically.
Yeah.
And I think we might need to overcome that. I think we need to accept that we live in a quite both pluralistic and partisan society and world, that science is not the only source of evidence that people are getting.
Yes.
And that being open to different ideas doesn't necessarily mean that we're ceding the ground to them, and it doesn't mean that we are not clear in our response about what our understanding of what is true is, or right.
Yeah. Bowen would call that differentiation. Right. That I am not dependent on what you think of me for my identity, and my identity is not so, what's the right word? Fragile that any other dissenting opinion makes me question everything, right? Like, I am okay with who I am and what I believe, and independent of, like, what other people believe or tell me. And this is true for research labs, right? Like, you know, if you've got a PI of a lab who's been there for 30 years and the expert of their domain, it might sting a bit to hear criticism, because you're not criticizing the lab. Like, there's not differentiation between the person and the lab. Like, you have merged.
Yeah, the world,
and there's one identity, right?
One other very small thing is making the claims a little more scoped is maybe okay. You said something a few minutes ago that touched on that. Maybe you're not comfortable sharing your idea on this big question, you know, are humans causing climate change? But how about if we ask the question, is it getting warmer, you know, in the last 20, 30 years?
Yes.
I don't know. You can probably get a lot more people on board, whether you're, you know, a rural Shelby Countyan or a metro, you know, Davidson County resident to such a discussion.
I have a colleague in public health here who, I want to say he's from North Dakota, but it might be South Dakota, one of the Dakotas. And he was having a conversation with some of the folks, because ice fishing is really big up there. And he said, you know, when you were growing up, 50 or 60 years ago, 70 years ago, what was the ice fishing season like? Oh, we could get out there in early November and, you know, fish all the way until early, mid-April. And what's it like now? Oh, we can't get out there until January and, you know, have to get off the ice in February. Oh, that's interesting. Like, so you've got less time on the ice. Why is that? Well, you know, it doesn't freeze as early or as deep or whatever. And, you know, it's the humanizing, right? It's like putting people in their context.
Humanizing is a great word.
And not in a gotcha kind of way, but in a, like, let's have a conversation about this. Like, and I think it's, people are afraid of getting got, you know, like, not like, aha, now I've gotten you to admit that you're wrong or that I'm right or something. Yeah. That it's just about...
Humility is a great word.
Yes, too. Humility, exactly.
It cuts both ways in that we've been talking, I think greatly so, about, like, how to invite people into the discourse of science.
Yeah.
But this also cuts both ways in that scientists, myself, you know, us, can, maybe should be... humble too about what we know and about, yes. You know, maybe under these conditions our claim is pretty strong and robust to different specifications of the model and various sensitivity analyses,
yes.
But maybe in the wider world, which is quite complex, maybe yes. We're wrong and we need to be open to that possibility as well. Maybe the person who we might, sorry to speak in such strong terms, maybe denigrate because of their unscientific views might have something to tell us. And again, that's not in a nihilistic sense, and I am someone who has dedicated my entire professional career to science, and I believe strongly in its power for understanding the world and improving our lives. But I also think some degree of humility could instrumentally serve us well and could be appropriate too.
And there's a really concrete example of this. I work with farmers up in Illinois, and you know, one of the things that I hear consistently is that test plots at land-grant institutions don't scale well. And so you might get certain results on, you know, a 50-foot long, you know, 10-foot wide test plot, but that might not hold at scale, you know, like for a 1,000-acre farm or something. And so doing something in a really controlled environment might look different in the wild.
That's a great point. As an aside, that's like the problem of educational research. Oh, you've done this one time, looks great, let's do it across this entire district or across an entire state context.
Yes.
And it's just very hard.
it is. But I think that that's also like the humility of saying, you know, we know this about this in this context, and there's more to learn. Okay, so last question here. What are you doing for fun these days?
Oh, great. Excited to get to plug this. I am working on a hiking book with my wife, Katie. So it's almost done. It's almost out. It's called Little Kids, Big Adventures, and it's on family hikes around Knoxville. So it's going to be published by UT Press in the winter of 2026, winter, early spring. So maybe I'll sign.
Just come back for a podcast about this.
Sure, thanks.
Oh my gosh.
My wife is the writer. I used many of my data science skills to work on the maps and all the trail info, and the whole book is written in quarto, as it were. Not LaTeX. not as fancy. It's kind of a computational book, but it's a book with a lot of heart, and so it's been really fun. Also took all the pictures, well, many of the pictures, and my friend took many of the others anyway, so it's a fun little passion project. So.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so what is the target audience for this?
People who are interested in hiking with mostly younger kids. At a certain age, kids can just hike adult trails. Once they're hit, maybe, I don't know, roughly 12, 13, 14. The kind of books converge. A hiking book and one for kids are kind of the same thing. But for hiking with a 2-year-old or even a 6-year-old or even a 8-year-old, requires kind of a nice combination of, well, certain things. You can have fun on any trail, but we try really hard to tell the story of how different trails around Knoxville, 30 in total, roughly 10 in the Smokies, 10 in the Cumberland Plateau, and then 10 around Knoxville, can be suitable to anyone interested in hiking with children.
Wow. So is the intended audience is adults, like
parents? I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question. Mostly, caretakers others who... I guess to kind of answer it in terms of a short story. So I've had many colleagues who are like, oh, Josh, we like heard you like hiking. Like, where should we go with our kids? Like, that's like the classic question. Like, we moved here 2 years ago.
Right.
We like are kind of interested in hiking. We've been to Imes, this really nice kind of urban wilderness area around Knoxville. We want to go to the Smokies. Where should we go? And so the answer is in the form of a book. Like, here, take this.
Amazing. A consolidated resource that's a public good.
Yeah.
Amazing. So do you hike outside of Tennessee, or what's your favorite hiking story?
Thanks. This all started during COVID when we'd moved to Knoxville. Uh-huh. We didn't really have friends, kind of sad. and yeah, COVID was going on. We had a 2-year-old. And my wife was in grad school. So there was a period where, it was actually fall of 2020. So that first COVID fall.
Yeah.
Where every Saturday for like 8 weeks straight, I took my son hiking, and that kind of started it.
Yeah.
And then the next spring, we, Smokies was closed for a bit.
Yeah.
No, it reopened in that summer. But anyway, we then started, I think that summer actually of 2020, we did some family hikes. I did a ton with my son. And then that next year, it was sort of just on. We started camping more and hiking. And so we've mostly, I mean, the Smokies are like the special, I don't even know how to describe them. Smokies are amazing.
Yeah.
We mostly hiked around Tennessee, mostly within an hour's drive. Cause then you can, you know, get the kiddos napping on the way back.
Yes. Yes.
Stop at a restaurant or a brewery even on the way home.
Yes. So,
really love the Knoxville area for that region. And Tennessee is really, maybe underrated place for different outdoors, opportunities.
Do you know about what is it called? The Treehouse. It's somewhere in the Knoxville area. I'll find it and send it to you. But it's some like amazing treehouse resort.
Oh.
Not really resort. Maybe kind glamping is closer sure. to
Glamping's
it.
Great.
Why can't I think of the name of it? Anyway, I follow them on Instagram.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, please send it.
It looks beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us today for the podcast. This has been just a lovely conversation.
It has been. I've learned so much. Thank you, Leah.
I have as well. Thank you.
To learn more about the Institute for Intelligent Systems, please visit iis.memphis.edu. Theme music for the Intelligent Systems podcast was created by Jason David Cooper.